Does anybody in our space like to trade time for money? The answer is going to be a hard no. We don't like trading time for money. However, in that instance, when I can sit with somebody and trade time over a Zoom call or a small group over a Zoom call and just give some actionable items and watch them move the boulder up the hill each week, I'm okay with trading some of my time for that.
You're a working professional, but struggling to balance the workload of your career, family, obligations, and preparing for your financial future? If so, this podcast is for you. You've spent years learning your craft, and now it's time to focus on your financial future. This podcast will teach you what you need to retire wealthy and happy. Let's dive in.
Hello, and welcome to the Retire Wealthy and Happy podcast. I'm Roger Jacobson, and I've got Anthony Esparza with me. Today, we're going to be interviewing Sean Magler. How are you doing today, Sean?
Good, buddy. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate you having me on today, Roger.
I really appreciate you. We're excited to hear your story. You've got a interesting story that kind of parallels some of my construction experience and stuff like that. And now you're a hard money lender and a coach in the Maryland, Washington, D.C. area. Why don't you give us a little introduction?
For sure. Thank you for the opportunity. So as you said, my name is Sean Magner. I'm based out of the Baltimore, Maryland metro. To kind of sum up my business, what it looks like is I run a boutique, a collective of real estate investment businesses based in Baltimore. We have a sizable rental property portfolio consisting of long-term and short-term rentals. I also have a fix and flip business. We're not currently actively running too heavily, but the predominant focus of my time is on my hard money lending business and a coaching mastermind that we've recently launched. Really, other than that, just an intro, just living locally here in the Baltimore, Maryland metro down near Annapolis, Maryland with my wife and my son. I won't get too far into my backstory just yet. I'll wait for your questions until I get to do that. But that's kind of the canned bio intro, if you will.
Awesome. Love Sean, it's great to have you on here. This is my first time meeting you, so looking forward to getting to know you. If you wouldn't mind, maybe do jump in and give us your story. Did you start flipping houses first and kind of how did you get to where you are now?
Sure. Happy to do it, man. I love this conversation. And also, Anthony, good to meet you as well, buddy. So kind of my story goes way back a bit. I won't go too granular, but shortly after high school, I had no direction. Wasn't sure where I was going. Didn't have plans for college. I kind of came from a broken home and my dad didn't have the kind of capacities to steer me in the direction of college. So when I got out of high school, all of a sudden my friends were heading off to school and I don't know what the hell I was going to do. And so like a lot of people, I heard there was money in the trades. And so I started pushing brooms around job sites and swinging hammers. Learned that I had a great interest in the trades. My family has a background there as well. So I decided to get a formal education from a trade school in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where I grew up. And after that, I graduated with an Associate of Applied Science and major in carpentry. That's the extent of my formal education. People often don't believe that that's a real thing. In fact, it is. Today, I actually sponsor an endowed scholarship back at the school, putting students through the program. But I've got a lot of love for the trades. But anyhow, so I got out of the trade school, swung hammers for a few years with some different remodeling and new home construction builders, remodeling contractors in the central Pennsylvania area. I got to know one of their building material salespeople that would come to our job sites, a guy that worked for Pella Windows and Doors. It's a brand a lot of you are probably familiar with. And I got to know him. He took a promotion at his job and said, hey, you should consider interviewing for this and to kind of leave the field, right? I've been swinging hammers. I really enjoyed it. But I remember there was a time I sat down on a job site. It was a smoking hot day. I sat down on a job site for lunch with a couple of my coworkers, and one of them was this old guy named Ray. Ray was probably in his mid-70s at the time. And this old man was wearing knee pads. If we were hanging siding, it didn't matter. He had knee pads on. He ached when he sat down. He ached when he stood up. And I remember just looking at him and thinking, man, that can't be my story, right? That can't be me. I can't be 70 years old sitting on this job site. So I decided to take a chance on myself when my friend from the building material space kind of approached me. And so I interviewed. I got the job. I worked for about 7 years for Pella Windows and Doors, and my time there was in retail sales. So I'd go into people's homes to sell them window and door replacement packages. But that big company, they poured into their salespeople. So they really brought in like high heavy hitters from the outside to train their sales force. And I use that sales training, a lot of that stuff to this day still, in fact. And so I did really well there, and I ended up kind of bouncing to a couple different companies when sales leadership, middle management, and leadership roles came available over the years. And by doing all of that, leaving the field for sales and sales management, it allowed for both some financial and time freedom, a little more flexibility than I had before. And that allowed me to entertain things outside of my job. And real estate investing was always something I had an interest in. This is going back a few years when the Flip This House or Flip These Houses or whatever, the HGTV shows were pretty big. And of course, I had a real interest in that. I didn't know how to connect the dots though. And so I responded to a commercial on the radio for a coaching mastermind for real estate investing. And so I responded to it. I joined this mastermind and I got cracking. And that was in 2015 is when I joined that coaching mastermind. And kind of the rest is history. I started flipping houses, started doing some wholesaling and flipping houses, eventually got me to where I am here today with the coaching and hard money business. So I know I probably skipped over quite a few things in there, but any questions on that? It looks like you both have a couple of thoughts.
Yeah, we talked about that a little bit and definitely was a good coaching program in the end for you. What did you start with? Did you do a flip first?
Good question. Yeah, I did. So I joined wanting to flip houses. I also came with some money from my retirement accounts that I, in a way, liquidated. So I didn't have to start by the grind of wholesaling, right? So I started by wanting to flip. And I did. I started flip, but I put my first flip under contract in November of 2016. And in January of 16, I met a new mentor who introduced me to the BRRRR strategy, right? The buy, renovate, rent, refinance, and repeat. I'd never heard of that. I thought I was going to have to flip a whole bunch of houses, have enough money for a down payment, get some bank funding for the balance, and go buy rentals that way. I'd never even heard of BRRRR. And so when he introduced me to that concept, I just went hard. So fast forward to June of 16, and I sold that flip for $21,315. I'll never forget it. But more importantly, I had five rentals under renovation at the time. So, and then you fast forward to October. So in the first year, I had now had 18 rental units under contract or in under management that I owned and was kind of off to the races. So yes, I did start with flipping, but quickly got away from flipping and got right into rental acquisition. And to this day, I've done far more rental acquisitions and deals than I have flips.
That's really cool. Just a technical question, but when you left Pella, that was your retirement funds that you used, correct?
It is. That's correct. It was.
And did you take a loan out from your 401k or did you convert it to a self-directed or how did you do that?
The latter. I converted all my retirement accounts. I had some 401k money in older companies and previous companies. I rolled them into a Roth IRA with a custodian that offers self-directed products. And so everything got converted into self-directed Roth IRAs.
That's really cool. That's something we're trying to teach people. And you did it a long time before our podcast. So bravo.
Thanks. Learning about self-directed IRAs, and of course, for those that don't know, I mean, not every custodian offers self-directed products. It depends on the, you know, you need to work with the right custodians, but I had a great stockbroker that I was working with. I wasn't buying individual stocks. I had some of my own personal money, put it into 401ks with my companies up to the match. And then anything excess, I was paying a broker for just to build out a mutual fund portfolio for myself. And I was young, so I was aggressive, but I didn't know what I was doing, right? I had no idea what stocks I even owned. I didn't fully understand it, but I understood building. I understood a tangible asset, a hard asset, and how to operate one of those made simple sense to me. It's kind of common sense. So I kind of went all in and took the control back, right? And to this day, I mean, I married, my wife has a stock portfolio, but otherwise, if it weren't for that, I don't own a single stock. Everything I'm in is in real estate and cash, and we can get into that then. But yeah, I decided to roll into a self-directed so that I could have some kind of checkbook control.
Very cool. Thank you. And now you're how many doors of short and long-term?
We're nearing 50. We're in the 40s.
That's awesome.
So Sean, you mentioned you started in 2015 is when you did your first wholesale deal. Shortly after that, you got into short-term rental. Was it a slow process to get your first, second, third rental? And then it kind of just started adding up when you found the strategy and formula, or did you have to take some losses and take some hits here and there till you finally perfected it?
Good question. A couple things there. So my first deal wasn't a wholesale, it was a flip. And then it was long-term rental acquisition. I only got into short-term like last couple of years, but great question though. I like it. So have I taken losses? Yes. But right out of the gates, I didn't. The reason for that is I found myself a solid mentor, somebody that helped me cut the line. They were my cheat code. And anybody listening, I highly advise a mentor. I've got a friend who's kind of skeptical about mentors. What's in it for them? I'm like, buddy, it's not about income. It's about impact. So first of all, I did join that coaching mentorship. So I had some education in the real estate investing space. But then I met a local person who owned a lot more doors than I do and introduced me to some concepts and kind of put his arm around me and kept me safe, right? So didn't take losses right out of the gate. So what I did is I met with this local mentor on about 120 doors. And he kind of introduced me to the BRRRR concept, like I said. And he and I spent a lot of time together. We were inseparable for a couple of years. And he introduced me to some of his team members, right? Some of his resources. So I'd go looking at houses with some of them, and some are agents, some are contractors. And listening to them explain things and answer my questions helped me to avoid taking those losses. And on the rental space, initially, at least, this was back 2015, 2016. I was buying doors in Baltimore City for 30 to 50 grand, dropping 30 to 50 grand into them, being worth 150,000. And they cash flow $500-$600 a month. And so it was kind of difficult to take a loss in that type of a strategy, right? Because I just wasn't super aggressive. I said I bought 18 doors my first year, but 10 of those were from a seller financed rental property portfolio that I acquired from a guy. So I didn't take losses right out of the gate. No, I've definitely taken losses more so on the flip side than anything. But on the rentals, I mean, as long as you hold on to them, it's hard to lose, right? But so that's really how I avoided some of those lessons early on, was I attached myself to some great mentors that kind of kept me safe.
That's super cool. It's like Roger, he's my mentor right there. So definitely know what you're talking about. On your first couple flips you did you do the work? You mentioned you were into the trades, or did you just sub it out?
I subbed it all out. I definitely subbed it all out. By that point, my calloused hands had gotten soft again, right? Because I was in sales for so many years. So I wasn't swinging hammers and getting in my own way. Plus, and I coach people in doing this, even in my hard money business, when I talk to borrower clients, to self-manage a project is one thing. To swing hammers on your own project, oh man, you're just getting in your own way. You're going to delay your goals for sure. I understand that if you buy a lean deal and you've got some time, it makes sense to do on the surface. But if you dig into it, it never makes sense to do. It never makes sense to be on your own job site, pushing brooms and swinging hammers, unless you're bored and you want to stop by, right? But in my experience, it just never makes sense to do these yourself. So I subbed everything out. I hired general contractors. I've done a couple where I acted as a general and I hired each individual sub. And even then I got in my own way because those subs didn't prioritize me. I wasn't feeding them regularly. I was feeding them on that one deal. And so they didn't have any loyalty to me. And so hiring a general contractor has just been the ticket for me. Plus they get things done so much quicker. They know the way around. If there's local permit issues and local municipalities, they know them very well, better than I do. So no, I didn't do any of the construction. Or not once, actually.
Nice.
So now in your hard money business, how big is that? How many loans do you have out at the same time?
We're boutique in size. We keep anywhere from about 20 to 30 loans outstanding at any given time. We'll probably do about 50 loans a year, somewhere in that range.
That's cool. How do you run those as far as protecting yourself, making sure it's a good deal, and making sure that they're performing?
Great question. To answer the latter, to make sure they're performing, that I stay on top of. We don't defer interest payments to the payoff. We collect payments along the way. I do all of our draw inspections personally still. That'll probably eventually evolve into something different, but I do all of our draw inspections so we can make sure that the project is moving along. But on the front side, we're pretty conservative in our underwriting. Basically, all of Maryland, predominantly in central Maryland, which is where Baltimore, Annapolis, DC is, and then southern Pennsylvania, where I have some ties. And so I say that specifically because it helps me keep things safe, right? I know this market very well. All of my own resources are here. All of my own personal experience has been here. And so for that, those reasons, I can keep us all safe. But when it comes to conservative underwriting, I mean, if you underwrite a deal, a deal's a deal's a deal. You can underwrite a deal anywhere if you use some of the standard rules of thumb: distance, size, square footage, bed bath count. If you keep things similar, it's pretty easy to run comparables. But in a place like Baltimore, every location has its nuances. But Baltimore is widely known for being block by block, right? So a comp from a half a mile away doesn't cut it, right? And so you've got to know those things. I'm sure the same is the case in your own home markets, at least in the metro versus out in the suburbs or more rural areas. So how do I keep things safe? If you know anything about borrowing hard money, the most important number to a hard money lender is ARV, right? Because that's what our loan amount is based on. It's not a matter of this borrower X qualifies for $1 million loan because their credentials say so. It's all about the collateral. We're asset-based, collateral-based lenders. And so it always comes down to ARV. Our loan amount is a relative percentage of ARV. So, and you've probably heard these before, but 65% loan to value, 65 LTV. What does that mean? That means if a borrower says, Sean, I have a house that's going to be worth $200,000 when it's all said and done. When we renovate it, ARV is 200K. I know right away the max loan I'm going to give is about 135, right? Because that's 65% of 200,000. Why is that the case? That 35% spread is what keeps us safe. It's what keeps my capital safe, my investor's capital safe, my borrower safe. And so when I underwrite, to kind of speak directly to your question, Roger, that's how I keep us safe. When I underwrite these things to 65 LTV on the front side, so when I fund, I'm funding around 65 loan to value. I track also the backside payoff. So if it's a flip, I track the sell price. If it's a rental, I track the appraisal value. And I compare that to where I underwrote it initially. And we're always trending behind that. Our actual LTV is closer to 58 to 60% LTV, which means that we're very, very safe. I track that very specifically because I don't change my underwriting guidelines. So if I start to see that 60 creep up to 62, 64, 65, I know the market's changing. That's a metric that helps me keep my finger on the pulse because I don't change my guidelines. I don't change how I underwrite a deal. So that's how I keep things safe.
Nice.
Very cool. And to explain that to our listeners, if you were to have to foreclose, it's basically like buying a deal at 65%. So if you had to buy a house at 100%, very risky. If you can take it back 65%, it's at a discount, very safe. I love the strategy.
Yeah. And the other thing is, if I have to take back a house, there's legal fees involved. Granted, I mean, somebody's got to pay for that. That's where that cushion comes in. If it's close to the finish line, and I needed to send my own resources in to get it finished or to contact somebody to sell it, whether it's an auction company or an agency, there's a cushion there. There's a spread there that's going to keep me from taking a loss, hopefully, on having to kind of do a take back or a workout of some sort.
And have you ever had a foreclosure or a deal that falls apart and you do need to take it back? Or have you all, because of your conservative...
No, I haven't had to take one back. I've had a couple that have gone long and borrowers stopped paying. We're a 6-month loan, and I can get into the granulars of what our loan products look like if you'd like, but we are a 6-month loan. And I've had a couple borrowers go beyond a year. One of them stopped paying halfway through. That one I thought was going to potentially, I was going to have to do something, forbearance, deed in lieu, foreclosure, something. Didn't have to. I dodged a bullet with that one, but no, I've not had to yet.
Awesome. And what was the tick that made you get into hard money lending? Was it, you know, just doing your own flips and that kind of sparked the interest?
That's a good question. So I find that most hard money lenders come from one of two backgrounds, at least locally in my market. They either come from a mortgage banking background or success in the remodeling, the flipping space. I come from that latter. But what happened with me is back in 2020, 2021, I went through and refinanced a lot of my portfolio. Probably half of the portfolio I refinanced. And if you know where interest rates were back then, they were very favorable. I was able to cash out a few $100,000. Instead of just self-funding some of my deals or starting a new business, well, I did start a new business, but instead of like getting out of what I had been doing or switching things up or doing it differently, I decided, I have a picture of a whiteboard. It was pretty cool. I've got a whole list of everybody that I sat down with and talked to and all the strategies that we talked about. I wanted to be a good steward of that money, right? I was getting married. We were expecting a kid. I had different considerations to make as I was going to come into that cash. And so I sat down with a lot of people, and the two people that seemed to resonate the most with me as far as personality wise, that I was friendliest with, that were tight with me, I was very close to, they were both said most of their money's in hard money. So I started exploring that model, learning more about it. Of course, I'd used hard money from a borrower side, but I hadn't really gone deep on the operational side of a hard money business. And when I did, I quickly learned that I really liked that model. I liked the model a lot. Also, something I skipped over is pre-COVID, I was traveling around the country speaking for and coaching for, at the time, the nation's largest real estate investment education company. And I'd had the opportunity to speak on stages, and I'd say something to the crowd, and I'd see someone in the front row's eyes light up. I don't know what it was that I said, but I just connected a dot for them, right? They found the nugget they came there looking for. And I don't know what it was specifically, but I loved that. That was powerful. I knew I was making an impact. Well, hard money allowed me to do that again, too. I could now sit across the table from a borrower, have a conversation with them and keep them safe, connect some dots, provide a resource other than just money, leverage some of my experience and my resume to help them. And so it was really helpful in that way too. So not only did I like the model from a dollars and cents standpoint, but I also really liked the kind of impact that I could have outside of just making money. So that's how I got into hard money. I just like the model. I really do. I like the model a lot. I like raising capital. I like deploying capital responsibly. And I also like that it's quite a bit more passive from a day-to-day operational standpoint than flipping houses.
Really cool. I think it seems like a good fit, especially with your background and experiences with your real estate investing. So that'd be really cool to get into one day. Personally, I think I would like to do something like that.
I enjoy it. I enjoy it a lot. I really do. A lot of reasons, but it's just a great model. It's a great business.
So in May, we met at Bridger Pennington's Fund Launch Live. Have you started a fund? Do you plan on starting a fund?
I have not. I went down there with a good buddy of mine because he and I were considering starting a fund. He got into the multifamily syndication space. I stayed residential. But what got me interested in attending that specific event was private equity. I have a great interest in buying businesses. I haven't done it yet, but I plan to. And I thought starting a private equity fund would be of an interest to me, learning more about that. So when I went down there, that's kind of what I had in mind. I haven't started a fund yet. I know some folks in my space with hard money have started debt funds. We haven't. We just have capital investors that we co-invest with, co-lend with. But No, I've not started a fund, but I plan to down the line, likely when I move over into the private equity space, but that's a few years away.
Love it.
Yeah. Private equity's got me really interested. I don't know if you guys know much about buying businesses, but that's something that's got a real interest to me for sure. I mean, a lot of reasons there as well, but no, I mean, I'm not there yet. I'm still in the residential real estate space, building out my business and systematizing it and automating it. But I don't think I'll leave it anytime soon. I really enjoy what I'm doing. But I just like building things, right? I like building these businesses. And so to step into an existing business that's ready to grow, failing business that needs realigned, or just growing a business from scratch, I just really enjoy it. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I love the model that it's taking a business and fixing its problems. And one of the things that we get held back on residential is whatever you do, it's just going to be based on selling it with a comp that will hold it down. When you take a business, you can actually capitalize on the net operating income, and that, you know, the sky's the limit. The syndication model is a cookie cutter version of that, where you can take a business that's a 50 unit multifamily, and you know pretty much with a grain of salt that you're going to sell it for an exact amount. You can say, this is what it will sell for. This is what the market rents are. This is what we can decrease expenses to. And this is what we can increase net operating income into. And it's very cut and dry, very easy to figure out. But with a business, you can really capitalize on a lot more people and spaces and sales.
You know what I found interesting about the business? I was approached by a young guy who I responded to something online, and one of their sales guys, I guess it was, just called me up. We had a really good conversation. And this guy bought into businesses by adding value, not dollars. And I thought, well, how? Tell me more. So this guy, this is pretty incredible. When I talked to him, he was down in Costa Rica. I think it was 22 or maybe it's 23. His goal that year was to spend a month in different countries. I'm like, all right, that sounds pretty cool. He was a young guy, so he'd get away with that. And he's good at building sales funnels, online sales funnels. He was pretty proficient at it. And he approached the kind of battle test and proof of concept, to gain some proof and concept, he approached a few local real estate teams in his market. He was out of the Philadelphia area. And he approached a few of these teams and said, hey, if I can double your lead flow or double your revenue dollars in X period of time, will you pay me X dollars? Just a flat fee, just for kind of a consulting type of a thing. And he did that a couple times successfully. So then he approached a general contractor when he was ready to go, when he was ready to actually put this into this proof and concept into action. He said, hey, Mr. General Contractor, you've got a few trucks on the road. You're doing very well. If I can increase your revenue by X, would you give me a 30% equity position in the business? Right? He was like, I think he was going to double the business. If I can increase, or even 50%, if I can increase your business by 50 to 100%, will you give me a 30% equity position in the company? He said, sure. Over a period of time, I think it was 90 days or 6 months, something like that. And a few months in, the guy called him up and said, hey, let's sign you on, man. You're crushing. You're keeping our sales guys busy. They put sales funnels into place, and he works with those sales guys to convert these leads into sales. He just beefed up their marketing and beefed up their sales closing rates and ratios. And he was telling me that he takes a $17,000 to $21,000 monthly, on average, monthly ownership distribution from that business. I'm like, okay, man, that's exciting. So good for him. And I mean, that, like you said, Roger, you can rinse and repeat that. That's one company that he approached. Now, I don't know if this part was true, but he says he spends about 4 to 6 hours a week improving and tweaking their funnels and working with their salespeople to keep that going. But when he was brought on as like a, you know, a sales manager or whatever his title was. But man, that was pretty cool. So you can certainly buy into these things, or you can add value and to kind of come into these businesses. So there's a lot of different ways to do it. And private equity, please don't be confused. I'm not an expert in this space yet. It's just one that I have really a great interest in.
Soon to be an expert.
Hopefully. Likely, yeah. I get tunnel vision, so I will go deep on this when the time is right.
Nice. Talk a little about coaching.
Sure. So the coaching started kind of like I said earlier, when I was traveling around the country speaking for and coaching for this big company, I was able to make an impact. It wasn't about the money necessarily. It was about making that impact and helping people connect dots. And that kind of went away when the pandemic hit and you weren't allowed to fill rooms with people and talk, right? So that went away. It kind of came back in the hard money space. But then I had countless conversations over the last 2 years with people asking if I offered any coaching. And I have people come here. I've got a big whiteboard on the wall to my right. And I actually just got a text over the weekend from a good buddy of mine. He runs a successful business. And he asked me if we could get together and whiteboard, because it's kind of my thing, right? Can I come over to Sean's place and do some whiteboarding? Because I like to kind of reverse engineer and deconstruct people's problems and help them connect the dots backwards, right? And so the coaching came to be because I wanted to kind of get back to making that impact. I have some good revenue producing, cash flow producing businesses So it's not just about the income. Of course, I charged for coaching because I need these students to have motivation and skin in the game and reason to show up and take action. But really, it was just about, I wanted to get back to it. I really enjoyed making an impact. And also, I read a book last year, and I know, Roger, you're going to ask this question. I'll save this to the end. But one of the books that I read had this concept about always measure backwards, AMB, and connecting dots backwards, how you can't do it forward, you can only connect them backwards. And so that hit me. What allowed me to have any level of success in this space was that I aligned myself with people that have gone before me. And I've listened to them, and I've been coachable, and I've taken action based on what they've taught me. Wouldn't it be nice to turn around and reach back and pull somebody up the ladder with me? And so that's really where it came from. It's just about making an impact and helping others, really. Quite honestly, that's the real reason I got back into coaching.
Nice. That's a feel-good position to be in. I think that's really cool.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, does anybody in our space like to trade time for money? The answer is going to be a hard no. Look where Roger is right now, right? Like, you see a cabana above his head. We don't like trading time for money. However, in that instance, when I can sit with somebody and trade time over a Zoom call or small group over a Zoom call and just give some actionable items and watch them move the boulder up the hill each week, I'm okay with trading some of my time for that, right? Because it's a good use of my time.
The magnification is really incredible. Like, if I talk to one person, they may or may not take it. They may or may not use it. It may help them a lot. But if I speak on stage or a podcast or a large Zoom call or whatever, I can take my words, and rather than saying one word that does one thing, it can be one word that helps 100 people or 1,500 people, or really getting close to 100,000 downloads right now. And it's like, wow, I'm helping people that are in like Asia, Africa, all over the United States. And it's like, if I can help that many people, why would I get down to the nitty gritty and just give away one piece of advice and then pocket it into a can and never expose it to the rest of the world?
I agree with you. I mean, I've had so many one-off conversations, but I've left the lunch meeting thinking, wow, if I could have bottled that up and stuck it on a podcast for a greater audience, more than just the guy that bought me the burger would have gained some value, right? So yeah, you're right. I mean, there is something to be said about that. And that's a good way to look at it. I mean, the coaching is very much that. It allows me to help more than just one at any given time. And a lot of these things that we do are recorded so people can refer back to them, so that what I say today may not impact them as much as it might in 6 or 12 months when their business and themselves are in a different place. So you can refer back to that and think, oh my gosh, that's what he meant, right? Like, that stuff is powerful.
Coach is huge. I like to think Roger's my coach, but I hardly pay him anything.
Coaches just help you cut the line, man. I call us cheat codes. We help you cut the line, right? Learn from our mistakes. I've certainly made some of them and I've done some things to avoid them. And I'd love to be able to help others to do the same.
Absolutely.
Trading time for money is something to get back to. And I know the podcasts focus on retiring wealthy, and that trading time for money is an important thing in all of our, in this entrepreneurial space. We don't like to do it. I ran a wholesaling business for a time, and we still have some outbound marketing going on, but that was a house hustle. I don't know if a lot of your audience is real estate specific or not. And if they are, if they're residentially real estate specific or not, but the quicker you can get away from wholesaling and start doing some flipping and move from flipping to buying rentals, with each one of those plateau jumps, in my opinion, comes a greater level of time freedom. And that time freedom allows you to turn around and have a greater impact in whatever it is you want to do, whether it's at home or with your family or building a coaching business or a new business that allows you to give value some other ways. So I think something to harp on there, and I'm just bringing this up because it's something to talk about, is trading time for money and focusing on getting away from that sooner than later. You know, there's something that I see a lot of young entrepreneurs do is shooting with a shotgun. This is a couple of analogies I like to use. So shooting with a shotgun, if I were to go on an elephant hunt or a gorilla hunt, which I never advocate for, you should never kill either of those animals. But if you go on a hunt for one of those big animals, you're probably not going to bring a shotgun. You're probably going to bring a rifle. Well, why is that? Because you're going to take down bigger game. You need to have more localized, focused energy, right? If I want to break through that wall behind me and I walk up to it and start pushing, nothing's going to happen. If I start swinging my fist, I might get through. If I walk up there with a hammer or a chisel, it's drywall. I'm going to be through that in no time, right? Because I have concentrated, focused energy. And so I understand in the beginning, a lot of new investors and a lot of new entrepreneurs, they have to shoot with the shotgun. They're doing everything. They're wearing all the hats. But the sooner you can get away from the wearing all of the hats, the better, the bigger impact you can have, the bigger deals you can take down. You asked me earlier, Anthony, about, was I on the job sites doing the work? And the answer was no. And I advocate for that tremendously. I understand in the beginning why some might think they need to, or why they actually might need to in some cases. But the sooner you can get away from that and hire a general contractor, you free your time up to go do the other thing that you're best at, the better. So I say it all the time, the sooner you can sit down the shotgun and pick up the rifle, the better. So anyway, that was just a thought that I had that I thought I'd share.
I like that one a lot. I think I've had some personal moments in my life where I've realized, yeah, you don't really need to go work 40 hours a week to make money. And I think that's where my kind of entrepreneur side kind of started. Still trying to not give too much time and make some money, but I'm still in the shotgun phase, I'd like to think. But
just be focused on getting out of it, and you will.
Yeah, so super cool. I like those analogies really good.
I used to use one when I was with my coaching students. I used to use this bridge, this financial freedom island analogy, which I think is a cool one. Well, I'm talking about these silly analogies. Why not? So financial freedom island is where we're all trying to get to, right? When I was with these coaching students, we're all trying to build a bridge over to financial freedom island. And you start building your bridge, and your bridge looks like a fix and flip business. And you look off in the distance and you see Roger over there building this multifamily business, this multifamily bridge. And you think, wow, he's having some success doing that. Maybe I should do that instead. So you go over there and start building a new bridge that looks like multifamily. And you look off in the distance, you see Anthony building this rental property portfolio, single family rental property portfolio, and think, wow, he's having success doing that. Maybe I should do that. Or a wholesaling bridge. All of a sudden, you look back and a year or two or three has passed, and you've got a few bridges that are partially built that don't lead to anywhere, right? That's not where we want to be. Do one thing, go a mile deep on one thing, and then you can diversify. I don't know if you guys know Alex Hormozi. If you follow Alex Hormozi, I'm sure you both do. He has a great video and he shares this. And it's an analogy that I use a lot too. So when I saw this video, I thought, man, that's exactly right. You get rich doing one thing and then you diversify your money in multiple things. But if you want to go an inch deep on 100 things, A, you're not going to have any personal fulfillment. And B, you're not going to have the riches you'd like to have. You go deep on one, a mile deep on one will produce greater results than an inch deep on 100. There's just no way around it. And so I get it in the beginning. And I also understand that depending on who's listening, you may not understand how the heck you get out of the rat race, the 40-hour a week rat race, trading your time for money. But that's where mentorship comes from. That's where reading books comes from. A lot of my mentors are in these books behind me and in the library in the other room. I mean, a lot of my mentors I've never met. A lot of them are dead, in fact, right? You can learn from these folks and they help you connect those dots to get out off the hamster wheel.
I like that. It's a good analogy. All right, we're in the final four. First question, what is your favorite book?
Ooh, I mean, I guess I have to go with Old Faithful on the shelf behind me. As far as my favorite book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, Robert Kiyosaki, famous book. That book has changed a lot of people's lives. It produced for me, it generated the biggest paradigm shift that I've ever experienced in looking at life and business and finances. It teaches the differences between assets and liabilities and being a self-employed person versus a business owner and an investor and all of that. That book was a big one for me. I've gifted that book more than any book. So I'd probably say that book is my favorite. I've got a few favorites. I'll go with that one for now.
Nice. I like that book also. It kind of, like you said, a big paradigm shift for you. The way I looked at money after I read that book was like night and day.
I came from a broken home. My dad was working at Kellogg's, the cereal maker, just trading time for money in a factory floor where he would literally have a time clock and he had to punch in and punch out. And I wasn't taught lessons like Robert's rich dad. I was taught lessons like Robert's poor dad. I love my father more than any person alive. I respect him more than any person alive. But in the context of that book, my own biological dad is my poor dad. And so when I read that, I thought, wow, okay, I really need the power of mentorship really started sinking in back then. That book is just very powerful. Anybody that hasn't read it, it's not real estate specific, but that book was a paradigm shift in a big way for me.
A must read for sure. Question number two, what brings you happiness?
It's a great question. You know, the progress brings me happiness and my family brings me happiness. You know, I'm at a juncture in my life now. I have a toddler at home. I'm married with a son at home. And so different things bring me happiness today, right? My child, my family, that tremendously so. I feel that the control from my work, building something brings me happiness. Watching progress being made and something that I'm building and watching the vision come to life brings me happiness. But also raising my family. I know it's kind of a cliche thing to say, but I don't know if you guys are fathers, but when that little kid looks up at me and says something that just makes me melt, man, brings me to my knees, nothing can compare to it. Absolutely nothing can compare to it. Spending time with my own father, that brings me a tremendous amount of happiness. He's been my ride or die. He's never left my side. Like I said, I came from a broken home, so he's been the one consistent in my life forever. So he brings me a tremendous amount of happiness. And the time freedom and financial freedom that my businesses have provided allows us to go to a weekly diner every week together and spend some of those quality time together. So that's the type of stuff that brings me happiness. Yeah, I think that's probably the best way to answer that one.
Love that answer. I know Roger's a father. I am soon to be. I guess I'm a father to my dog. I just got a puppy. So.
That's a lot of work. I've been there too.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot of work. But that brings us to our third question. I know you probably already touched on this earlier in the podcast, but question number three is, what is your favorite way to give back?
That's a good one. My favorite way to give back is certainly by reaching back and helping others connect the dots. Specifically, and I think what you're referring to is I started a scholarship in my family name at my alma mater, a trade school in the town that I grew up in, or the area that I grew up in Pennsylvania. I feel strongly about the building trades. I do. And so for me to be able to start a scholarship at a place that I graduated from when I was in a place at the time that I thought I'd be shooting with a shotgun forever, and now I can come back and start a scholarship there, it just really gives me a lot of fulfillment. And also helping newer entrepreneurs just connect dots, whether that's in a paid coaching program, speaking at my alma mater where I have that scholarship, or even teaching my son some things. He's too young right now to take any business lessons, but that'll be one to come. But really, I guess the answer is just reaching back. You know, I read a book that called The Gap and the Gain. I don't know if anybody has heard of that book, but The Gap and the Gain. Roger, you're smiling. Sounds like you know the book.
We talked about this before, so I do have some inside information.
So The Gap and the Gain, that was the second book that I was going to mention earlier, Rich Dad, Poor Dad versus The Gap and the Gain. Dan Sullivan and Benjamin Hardy, they wrote a trilogy of three books and great ones. But this Gap and the Gain, I think, hit me at the right time. And I read it last year. By the time I was done with the introduction to the book, I had already ranked it up there next to Rich Dad, Poor Dad as far as paradigm shifts. Again, I think it's because of where I am in my life when I read it. But a few things that hit me was this AMB, always measure backwards. The subtitle of the book is something like Successful People's Guide to Happiness and something or other. The gap is where we tend to be stuck, where we're looking at where we are versus the horizon where we'd rather be, which we know is a horizon. It's ever moving. By the time you get there, it's going to have already moved on to something different. And so you get stuck there wanting more constantly, and that keeps us unhappy. And if you can use this tool, always measure backwards, to step out of the gap and into the gain, when you look backwards and you look at the progress made from the starting point to where you are today, you can get some happiness from that. You can gain some fulfillment from that and get out of that gap mindset. That book also talks about connecting dots backwards. You cannot connect dots forward if you've never done it, but you can reach backwards and connect dots. And so that hit me at the right time, probably. But that concept, always measure backwards and connecting dots for others, has really resonated with me. So that's how I give back, to help others connect the dots that they can't see yet.
I love that. What was that book called again?
The Gap and the Gain.
The Gap and the Gain.
Dr. Benjamin Hardy and Dan Sullivan.
Nice.
Great book.
Awesome. And question number four, what does your future retirement look like? And do you have a future retirement?
I like the second part of that question. I thought about that question coming into today, guys. And I got to say, there was a time that I thought I would likely retire at 60 and travel. I think when I retire, I'll be pushed out. I'll be forced out. I think that I love what I do so much, and I like building and growing. And also, if you know much about what brings just human happiness, it's not in the achievement, it's in the progress towards the achievement, right? There's a ton of studies that show these Olympians on podiums falling into deep depressions afterwards because they were happiest leading up to making progress toward the goal. And then when they got there, they had nothing left to go for, right? To fight for. So retirement for me is kind of a fluid thing. I think I have ideas of what I'd like for it to be, but that really depends on what happens between now and then. So what does that mean? I'd like a few homes and locations that my wife and I would like to travel to. I'd like to spend my time bouncing between those places, but I'm kind of a homebody, so I'd kind of like to be home. My closest mentor now is 73 years old and still working 5 days a week, and he loves it. And I think we're wired very similarly. So I don't know that I'll ever quit working, but there will come a time that I could choose to. I mean, I guess I could give a more hand answer of move my properties that are in LLCs into trusts, and I'll just take dividends from trusts and have whole life policies that feed me dividend. Like, as far as retiring and kind of kicking my heels up and not working, I don't see it happening, at least not right now. There was a time, though, that I said, you know what, I'm going to sell all my properties. I'm going to dump that money into an ETF, some sort of Vanguard 500 stock portfolio, just follow the S&P, take my dividends, pay my bills, and live a free life. But I don't know that that will ever happen. You get a lot of fulfillment from my work. And so at this point, I'm 40 years old. I think I'm still too young to look at retirement. And so what do I think retirement is going to look like? Man, it's going to be fluid. I don't know yet. But I like to think that I'll just be spending a few days a week checking in on my businesses and checking in with my team and spending the rest of the time having location freedom so that my wife and I can do and see the things that we want to.
Awesome answer. A very puzzling question, and seems like on this show, we get a kind of a similar answer from all the different entrepreneurs we have.
That's just it. If you're interviewing entrepreneurs, man, we're not idle hands. We tend to want to be doing. Yep. And so it just makes sense that you get a similar answer to that question, I guess.
And it's funny. I mean, all these episodes we've done, I used to think like, man, I want to make a ton of money and then I'll be able to retire early. And then everybody has such a similar answer. I'm like, well, guess I'm not retiring anymore. So I just got to find what I, you know, got to get in my groove and guess that's what I'll do.
It might happen. Things change, right? Your circumstances will change. But when you get in your groove, you're not going to want to get out of it. I mean, you just get a lot of fulfillment from the growth. Roger, I'm sure you feel that same way. I'm sure you get a lot of fulfillment from what you do from 9 to 5. You might have plans to retire at some point, but it might be a difficult thing. How about it? How about for you, Roger?
I think that once you have the location freedom, and I'm sitting here looking at the ocean from Belize, you don't really like feel the need for retirement because you can do what you want and love it. And if you can automate it and control things from wherever you are, you don't need to retire. There's no like, my retirement would be to shut down a few of the texts that have blown through while we've been sitting here on this podcast recording.
Right. Offload those to like, someone else.
Yeah. Some of them are like, I don't know if I really want to deal with that particular thing today. I'm on island time and I'm like about to go out and I'm going to fly my drone above the island. I'm going to kick my feet into the water. I'm going to walk on the beach. I'm going to go snorkel. I'm going to go wake my buddy up and say, hey, let's get this day done. Because he's got a list of things to do on his project here. And then let's go look at a cave or let's go set up a scuba. And yep. It's a beautiful thing. So,
yeah, one other thing. I mentioned something earlier that how I interviewed all those people and had all those conversations when I cashed out a few hundred grand and decided what I wanted to do was hard money. The two people that I was most similar to are both hard money lenders. And they both are in their, one's definitely 73, the other's in his late 60s, early 70s. They're regularly working. They always work. But right now, they travel abroad. They go on safaris for a month, they rent a villa in Italy for a month. They have a small team back home that's running day to days. And if they need to check in, they will. The other guy that I mentioned, he goes down to Florida and spends 3 months in Florida. And then he's traveling to his like mountain home in West Virginia regularly. So these guys, to your point, Roger, they both have location freedom if they choose it. And they don't have any need to quit. And one guy, the older guy that's 73, what he says often is, his biggest concern is relevancy. He wants to be relevant. And it's a big thing for him. And so that's why he's just worked so hard still. And so they have the abilities, they have the financial freedom to have time freedom, or the financial freedom to have location freedom. And they still choose to work really hard. Not really hard, not like swinging hammers for 40 hours a week hard, but they just enjoy it so much. So yeah, I think you're right. Once you get that location freedom thing down and you can do whatever you want from whenever you want, whenever you want, and you can still work, I feel like that's the best of both worlds.
Absolutely agree. And I'm looking forward to my future location freedom.
Well, don't wish it time, man, because I think a lot of the joy that you'll have between now and then is in the grind and in the growth and in the progress. So don't wish away time. Just enjoy it. Just enjoy the ride.
I love it. So we got through the final four. Sean Magner, thanks for being an awesome guest on the show. I've had an honor really getting to know you and hope we can get you back for another one sometime down the road.
That'd be awesome, guys. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate you having me on today. And I'd love the opportunity to come back and connect again.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much.
All righty, guys.
That's it for today's show, everybody. Thanks for joining us on the Retire Wealthy and Happy podcast. We'll see you next time.
Hope you got value from this episode. And if you have a minute, then take the time to leave an honest written review for the podcast, because we take those reviews seriously and it'll help us serve you better on the next episodes. And most importantly, be sure to start taking action so you can control your financial future today.